Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. Today is Tuesday, March 28, and I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, Lynn Mars Show Choir wins U.S. Championship. This story is by Aaron Jordan. There's no state tournament for show choir, no weekly rankings or coaches' polls, but when you stand on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville and accept the trophy for the National Show Choir Grand Champion after earning higher scores than 10 other first-rate groups from around the nation, you know you've reached the top. Our message to the kids is never about seeking that win, but it's nice to have the kids be honored in this way, said Trent Buglewitz, director of Lynn Mars 10th Street Edition, which won nationals on Saturday. The show choir also was recognized for having the best vocals, best choreography, and best band. Teha Gururaja won Outstanding Male Soloist during the preliminary round and Outstanding Male Performer in the finals. Grant Holloway won Outstanding Male Soloist in the finals, and Kira Cairns won Outstanding Female Soloist during the finals. This was the first time for Lynn Mar to go to the national competition in recent history. Show choir members climbed aboard two buses early Thursday and drove nearly 10 hours to Nashville, where the competition was held Thursday through Saturday. The Lynn Mar Varsity Show Choir includes 61 singers and dancers, as well as 31 band and crew members. Lynn Mar's 30-minute show, which Buglewitz created with his wife, Lexi, the group's choreographer, tells the story of Nicholas, who dies and goes to the afterlife to make a deal with the devil. Iowa Public Radio reported earlier this month in an interview with Lynn Mar and Waukee Show Choirs. The 10th Street Edition singers and dancers performed synchronized choreography while singing several songs from the Broadway musical Hadestown. The show ends with a rousing Devil Went Down to Georgia with Gururaja playing the fiddle. The show choirs that performed at Nationals this year were a combination of those who do a set of songs, sometimes united by a theme, and those that tell a story. It's a good mix in Nationals and all over show choir right now, he said. There's no rules to whatever we do. We just have to stay under 30 minutes. Show choirs are judged on singing and dancing, but groups across the country are trying new things and setting new precedents for what show choirs can and should do. The storytelling is what we really are passionate about in our program, Buglewitz said. The 10th Street Edition show was also unique in that most of the girls and boys wore the same costumes, gray suits, rather than suits or dresses that sometimes can make it hard for gender nonconforming students to find where they feel comfortable. Buglewitz talks with his students about how they can't control what other choirs bring to competitions or how the shows will be viewed by judges. Getting to compete at the Grand Ole Opry is the highlight, especially because more than 100 family members also drove to Nashville to cheer them on, he said. As the buses returned home Sunday night, parents, siblings, neighbors, and friends lined 10th Street, holding signs and shouting for the choir, just like their very own Super Bowl parade. And the article includes photos of the choir members holding up the trophy. Also on the front page today, Linn County likely to extend solar moratorium through June. This story is by Marissa Payne. Linn County will likely continue its pause on new utility-scale solar installations through June. The Linn County Board of Supervisors discussed Monday whether to extend its moratorium on new large-scale solar projects as Renewable Energy Review Committees wrap up their work to study the county ordinance governing the solar projects. A final vote on the extension is slated for Wednesday. The supervisors originally adopted the moratorium in October to last through December 31st, with the option to extend it up to three times through 2023 while the review is underway. They extended it previously through March. The moratorium does not affect the already approved solar projects near Palo and Coggin, which remain underway, but applications for new projects will not be taken until the pause is over. The review committees convene to make recommendations to the County Zoning and Planning Commission about potential changes to the current solar ordinance. Planning and Zoning would then vote whether to recommend changes to the supervisors. Any potential changes would not apply to previously approved projects. County Planning and Development Director Charlie Nichols said the four committees began to meet in January, focused on specific areas: battery energy storage systems, safety of the public and first responders, environmental standards, applicable building codes, example zoning code, good neighbor practices, mitigating conflicts between utility-scale solar uses and residential uses, balancing setback, screening, and sound requirements. Also, life cycle costs, ensuring adequate financial assurance over the lifetime for projects, balancing agriculture and solar, region-appropriate vegetation requirements, agricultural impact mitigation plan requirements, and scorecards. Recommendations that Good Neighbor Practice Committee is looking to make, Nichols said, are verification and enforcement methods for projects such as setbacks, sound, landscaping should be clearly spelled out in the ordinance. Policy should have baseline requirements to protect county residents and mitigate impacts to adjacent landowners, while keeping flexibility as every project is different. A point system like the land evaluation and site assessment system that's used to evaluate other developments within the county should be considered as a good model. There's a wide range of opinions, but they work together extremely well, Nichols said of the committee's work. Supervisor Kirsten Running Marquardt said she thinks the idea of a point system is a brilliant path to go down in evaluating projects. Who knows how many other projects we'll have, so I think something like this will help us keep a balanced approach for Linn County, she said. Nichols said the committee should be done meeting within the next 2 to 3 weeks. Their statements will be posted on the committee's website and placed on the board agenda to seek comment from the supervisors. Based on supervisors' feedback, planning and development will draft updates. Ordinance changes will be given to the Planning and Zoning Commission, which will then vote on final changes to recommend to the supervisors. All of that will likely take longer than 3 months, Nichols said, seeking an extension. I don't anticipate us receiving another utility-scale solar project before then. Running Marquardt indicated she'd support an extension of the moratorium. To protect our citizens and our county here, I think the fair and reasonable thing would be moving forward to allow you all to have the time without us worrying if somebody might drop an application that would fall under the old rules and the old code and would negate all this good work that we're doing collaboratively right now. Supervisor Louis Zumbach said it seems the committee's review is well on track toward completion. With Supervisor Ben Rogers absent, though, he tabled a vote on the moratorium extension until Wednesday's formal session. Also on the front page, public safety officers learn to fly drones. This story is by Emily Anderson. Drones, or unmanned aircraft systems, have become increasingly popular tools used by police departments and fire departments in eastern Iowa. The drones are used for everything from tracking suspects or missing people to investigating bomb threats to helping firefighters see through smoke when fighting a fire. The Cedar Rapids Fire Department and the Linn County Sheriff's Office, for example, used a drone earlier this month to pinpoint the location of a smoldering fire after a grain elevator exploded at the Archer Daniels Midland plant in southwest Cedar Rapids. The Decorah Fire Department in northeast Iowa has been using drones since 2014, longer than most departments in the state. At the time, the city had to get a special certificate to own and pilot a drone because the Federal Aviation Administration hadn't yet created the remote pilot certification process. Now, all drone pilots must be certified under the FAA's Small Unmanned Aircraft Systems Rule Part 107. Drone pilots in law enforcement and public safety often have additional training on how to use the drones appropriately in their work. One reason Decorah firefighters wanted a drone was because of the numerous river rescue calls the department receives about people tubing and canoeing the Upper Iowa River, which flows through the city. The drones have drastically decreased response times to those calls, according to Zach Kurnt, one of the department's four drone pilots. The drones give us a much better idea of where people are, generally because the information we receive from our dispatch center is very vague, he said. The information we usually get is they put in at this spot or this bridge and they're getting out at this bridge and they're somewhere in between. Having a drone really cuts down on the man hours it takes to find someone because we can find them with the drone and come up with a plan, he said. The department has two drones which are used about 20 times a year. The drones also are used during fires and in missing person cases. Since the drones have infrared cameras, they can see through smoke in a fire and can help firefighters in an aerial truck better aim water on what's burning. In law enforcement, the devices are often used to help officers get a clear picture from above of a crime scene or crash scene. The Linn County Sheriff's Office has four drones, two large ones, two small ones, and nine trained pilots, according to Lieutenant Dave Buter. It's a real-time depiction of the scene, of the environment, whether there's snow on the ground, whether the trees have leaves on them, Buter said. Especially with criminal investigations, it's nice to have those images from the drone, he said. You can go up in the air, even like 10 feet up in the air, and do an angle shot back into whatever you're looking at. It's a lot better depiction of what's seen than what just a simple photograph does. The sheriff's office started using the drones in 2017 after Buter and another lieutenant won a drone at a conference and then sought out training so they could use it. The Iowa State Patrol started using drones in 2020 when it bought 10. It now has 21 drones, which it primarily uses for crash reconstruction, according to the patrol's public information officer. The Cedar Rapids Police Department is currently readying its large drone, bought 3 years ago, with a grant for use in crash reconstruction. The department currently employs a FARO 3D scanning system that is positioned around a crash scene and uses lasers to create a 3D reconstruction of the scene. The drone will speed up that process and also provide photos that can be overlaid on a 3D crash depiction. The Cedar Rapids Hazardous Devices Unit, with team members from public safety departments in Linn County, bought the drone 3 years ago, mainly to examine hazardous devices or bombs from a distance. Let's say we had an improvised or suspicious device that could be out in an area that, based on some of the initial intelligence we have, we may want to get a better look at photos of that, said Dan Jabins, commander of the Hazardous Devices Unit. Instead of sending a person down there to put them in harm's way, we would use the drone to get better pictures and allow us to develop a game plan on how we want to mitigate that device, he said. The drone can carry up to 5 pounds, Jabins said. If an object seems especially suspicious, the drone can carry a mitigation charge over the object to remotely disable it if it's a bomb. To do a remote reconnaissance on a device somewhere could take hours if we had to work our way around and use traditional camera systems, Jabins said. With this, within a minute or two, we can clearly have a picture of what our device is, what we're looking at, and what the best way to mitigate would be. The Cedar Rapids Police Department has 7 officers trained as drone pilots and hope to train more so the device can be used in additional scenarios. There are situations where a drone cannot legally be used to the fullest extent of its abilities, according to Jabins, such as using it to view private property. For example, using a drone to search someone's property from above or to look through someone's window without a warrant likely would violate the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable search and seizure. The department's drone procedure policy states that drones shall not intentionally be used for the purpose of gathering evidence or other information, or to intentionally view, record, or transmit images or video around a residence or any other location where a person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. Turning now to the Iowa Today page, Marion Fire Department creating a community-led strategic plan. This story is by Emily Anderson. The Marion Fire Department has partnered with a Virginia-based nonprofit, the Center for Public Safety Excellence, to craft an updated strategic plan for how the department can best use its resources to serve the community. The department hosted a meeting Monday in the Marion Public Library with community stakeholders to get input on the strategic plan. Community members were asked to fill out forms rating the priority levels of various fire department duties. The Center for Public Safety Excellence will present the information gathered from community members to fire department staff over the next few days and help the fire department write the plan. Meeting invitations were sent to community stakeholders in an attempt to get a wide variety of perspectives. What we wanted to do is to try to get a cross-section of the different factions of the community. So academia, the business sector, media, healthcare, our partners in the city that we work with, and even everyday residents, Marion Fire Chief Tom Fagan said. Fagan started as the Marion Fire Chief 6 months ago after working as a firefighter in the Kansas City area for most of his life. He has worked with the Center for Public Safety Excellence when he was a member of other fire departments and decided to bring them in to help him get an idea of what the Marion community expects from its fire department. The community-driven piece of strategic planning is something because we're here for our community, and sometimes we don't know what we don't know unless we find out. So that's really what this is about, is getting that environmental scan, Fagan said. With me being new to the department, and actually the state of Iowa, this is a great thing that can help me as a tool to better connect with the department, better connect with the community on how we can serve them better in ways that are currently gaps for us. Fagan said he hopes to have a completed strategic plan to present to Marion City Council by early summer. The Marion Fire Department has been working on getting approval to relocate Fire Station 3 and build a fourth fire station in response to growth in the city. Fire station changes will likely be included in the new strategic plan. Also on the Iowa Today page, this story by the Gazette, authorities are seeking information about the illegal dumping of at least 25 coyote carcasses in Johnson County over the weekend. 13 of the carcasses were found Saturday on Eagle Avenue, just north of Rarrett Road Southwest, west of Iowa City. Another group of at least 10 carcasses was found nearby on Ivy Avenue Southwest, north of 400th Street Southwest, according to a Johnson County Sheriff's Office post on Facebook. Iowa's wanton waste law requires that the usable portion of game or fur-bearing animals be removed from the field. Also, it is unlawful to dispose of carcasses in a road ditch. Anyone with information can call the Iowa Department of Natural Resources officer, Erica Billerbeck, at 319-330-9710. And this by Emily Anderson, a suspicious package was found at the Cedar Rapids City Hall. The police and fire departments responded to the City Hall on Monday after receiving a report of a suspicious package at 7:47 a.m., according to a news release from the city. City employees evacuated while the Cedar Rapids Metro Hazardous Devices Unit investigated the item. The Hazardous Devices Unit determined the contents of the package did not pose a threat, and Fire Chief Greg Smith issued an all-clear for the building at about 9 a.m. The investigation is ongoing and no additional information has been released. Also on the Iowa Today page, this by Emily Anderson. A Cedar Rapids man was arrested Saturday, accused of sexually abusing a child several times over multiple years. Frank Volmar Acevedo, 53, is charged with four counts of second-degree sexual abuse and one count each of continuous abuse of a child, indecent contact with a child, and indecent exposure. The 10-year-old child told the Child Protection Center that Avecito abused her multiple times in two locations in Cedar Rapids when she was 9, in 2021 and 22. She said he began abusing her when she was 6 or 7, according to a criminal complaint. Acevedo is being held in the Linn County Jail. A non-contact order has been issued on behalf of the child. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from the New York Daily News from Saturday, titled "Hysterics Obscure Problems." The ubiquitous social video app TikTok did not have a great day, as CEO Xu Zichu was dragged before Congress to ostensibly testify, but really be berated by lawmakers out for blood. In more than 5 hours of testimony, they painted the company as some sort of nefarious Chinese government sleeper agent plotting against an unsuspecting public. There is plenty of cause for concern about TikTok's corporate practices and general societal impact. The company is opaque about its algorithms and foments the development of sometimes harmful online subcultures, often targeting children, causing damage to their mental health, spreading misinformation, and prioritizing engagement overall. It mines data and creates profiles of users and likely non-users, which can be tapped for everything from individualized advertising to more nefarious political manipulation and conspiracy mongering. Yet those undesirable attributes also apply to a decent chunk of Silicon Valley companies, and certainly almost all popular social media platforms. Hell, it's practically their business model, and they've fought tooth and nail to preserve it. So TikTok could be used to manipulate political audiences? Facebook and Twitter have plenty of experience with that. It encourages teenagers to adopt warped perceptions of healthy bodies and lifestyles. Instagram's got you covered. Its algorithm leads people to hateful content. That's YouTube's turf. It pulled user data to spy on journalists. Uber has done just that and worse. The point is not to shrug away others' misdeeds, but to point out that the whole tech sector lacks regulation, and to single out TikTok is to scapegoat it and divert attention from the sorry state of our modern public squares. And we've not seen evidence that TikTok, which is not available in China, is the advanced cadre of the People's Liberation Army. By all means, have bipartisan outrage at TikTok and its contemporaries too. But lawmakers moving to ban just TikTok under some rather strained and conspiratorial arguments about its ties to Beijing and then calling it a day are burying their head in the sand. And again, that is a reprint from the New York Daily News. The guest column today is titled, "Use Technology, Not Pipelines for Carbon." We are third and fourth generation family farmers in Northeast Iowa who rely heavily on the ethanol industry for a strong market for our corn. We are highly disappointed in the so-called study commissioned by the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association, advocating CO2 pipelines with an outcome designed to benefit the private pipeline companies of Summit, Navigator, and Wolf. The study ignored other options for addressing the problem at hand. Most troubling is that the so-called study assumes that the Iowans cannot innovate to find ways to protect their land, farms, and communities while also doing the right thing for the environment. Iowans are better than that. In particular, the study ignores other options for the CO2. Instead of paying billions to hopefully sequester and bury CO2, why not upgrade it to new valuable products like green methanol, DME, a net zero diesel fuel replacement, and sustainable jet fuel? These bolt on to current ethanol plants and other CO2 emitters. Some of these technologies are mature and some are currently being proven, but they are all better options than the unproven pipelines that will place permanent scars across the most fertile farmland in Iowa. These options bring significant new revenues to ethanol plants and their surrounding farms and communities. It is estimated that an average ethanol plant can add $160 million per year of new revenue by upgrading its CO2 emissions to green methanol. A green methanol solution qualifies for basically all the same tax credits and government incentives as the pipeline. The largest freight shipper in the world, Maersk, will need 2 billion gallons of green methanol to power their fleet of ships by 2030. Currently, the world only produces 170 million gallons. What an opportunity for Iowa agriculture and ethanol to be a part of this demand for energy for the future. Combine this with cropping practices such as cover crops, no-till, strip-till, and reduced tillage. We can generate a net negative carbon score for ethanol. What a win-win solution. You must not take ingenuity out of the equation. These new technologies will be in place long before a hazardous CO2 pipeline is finished. Just think of a pipeline to nowhere that is replaced by Iowans who did the due diligence to provide the best solution for CO2 emissions and at the same time provide another renewable fuel to this market for net zero fuels, all without a hazardous pipeline endangering our land and communities. The Iowa House just passed HF 565, restricting CO2 pipelines to 90% voluntary easements before eminent domain can be exercised by a large majority. And a Des Moines Register poll shows 78% of Iowans oppose eminent domain for the CO2 pipelines. I ask any landowner who is considering signing a pipeline easement to give time for these new technologies to blossom. CAP CO2 Solutions is one company that has technologies of green methanol. We strongly object to the assumption that the people of Iowa are not able to innovate to meet new challenges while still protecting their land, farms, and communities. And that's submitted today by Jeff and Mickey Reintz, who are corn farmers in Butler and Bremer counties. One community letter today, and its title is Keep Iowa Schools Safe and Supportive. I moved to Iowa 27 years ago to begin my teaching career. I've been proud to be an educator in Iowa and appreciate the quality education and the amazing support the teachers in the Marion Independent School District give my children. My main job as a teacher is to help kids be the best they can be and to keep them safe while they are in my care. As a mom, that's what I expected from the school and teachers, to help my children learn and to protect them from harm. However, the Don't Say Gay, Forced Outing, and Book Ban bills do exactly the opposite of what teachers are tasked to do. These bills will keep students from learning about the world by limiting information that should be accessible to them. How can you be a well-informed citizen if knowledge is kept from you? These bills will create tension and mistrust in the classroom. How can teachers build trust and form positive relationships if students are in constant fear of being outed or cannot be their true selves? Teachers know that a safe and supportive classroom leads to increased learning because relationships are the foundation of a quality education. These pieces of legislation will erode that foundation and will lead to lower student achievement. And that's signed today by Gretchen Lawyer from Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette today. It's Tuesday, March 28, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries, beginning with the short notices. First, from Center, Ruth Atwood, age 86, died Monday, March 27. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service. From Decorah, Dennis Zidlicky, 74, died Sunday, March 26. Helms Funeral Home is assisting the family. In Lansing, Charles W. Matlock, Sr., age 80, died Monday, March 20, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home. In Marion, two notices. First, David C. Heck, age 63, died Sunday, March 26. Also, Linda Maher, age 77, also died Sunday, March 26. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is assisting both families. In Olwine, Richard J., known as Rick Petchy, Sr., age 69, died Sunday, March 26. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. And in Tipton, Margaret A. Kettleson, 80, died Saturday, March 25th. The Fry Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Turning now to the regular notices, first from Olwine, Carol S. Piper, age 88, died Wednesday, March 22nd at Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Funeral services for Carol will be Monday, April 3, 10:30 a.m. at Christ United Presbyterian Church in Olwine, Reverend Paul Uzel officiating. We invite those attending to wear blue, Carol's favorite color. Visitation is Sunday, April 2nd from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine and for 1 hour before the service at the church on Monday, April 3. Interment will be at Floral Hills Memorial Gardens, rural Olwine. In Iowa City, Dale E. Baines, age 65, longtime resident of the Iowa City area, died Monday, March 20, at his home, surrounded by much love and fighting cancer like only Dad could. A gathering of family and friends to celebrate this amazing man's life will be held from 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, July 8, at the VFW in Iowa City. To share a thought or memory, please visit Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation website, gayandchia.com. From Minneapolis, Minnesota, Joe Cheripar Brown died February 15th at the age of 82. Memorial party, per Joe's wishes, will be April 15th at the CSPS Hall in St. Paul, Minnesota, from 1 to 5 p.m. Memorials may be sent to the Red Lake Homeless Shelter. In Cedar Rapids, Dorothy G., age 97, died Friday, March 24, at the Keystones of Cedar Rapids. Eulogy is at 2:30 p.m., visitation from 3 to 5 p.m. Friday, March 31st, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. She will be buried at Campbell Cemetery in Cedar Rapids next to her husband, Albert George G. From Marion, Gordon Ross Danielson, 91, died peacefully at home and went to his heavenly home March 26th. He was a beloved husband, father, grandfather, and great-grandfather. Visitation will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories Friday, March 31st from 1 p.m. until service time at 2 p.m. Pastor J. Gentink officiating. Interment to follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery, Garden of the Last Supper. Memorials may be made to Calvary Baptist Church in Cedar Rapids. From Independence, Joyce L. Webb, age 86, died March 26th at the ABCM Rehabilitation Center in Independence. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, March 29th at the Reef Family Center, Funeral Home and Crematory in Independence. Interment will be held at the Quasquetan Cemetery. You can visit reeffamilycenter.com to leave an online condolence. And in Cedar Rapids, Richard, known as Dick R. Hover, age 88, passed away Friday, March 24, at home. Memorial services will be held on Thursday at 11 a.m., with a visitation starting at 9:30 a.m. at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Marion. A luncheon will be held at the church. Memorials may be directed to Camp Courageous. Online condolences can be directed to the family at iowacremation.com. Turning now to the sports page, Girls Soccer Preview is the title for this article by Ryan Pagankul. Centerpoint Urbana soccer players Maddie Daly and Emily Bow were first team all everything last season, and the admiration the two have for each other is first class. "She was amazing," Daly said. "I did not expect to have a freshman come out like that. She scored, but she did a bunch of other stuff. Her passes are great. She sees the field so well. She knows what's going on around her at all times. We just love her." As a freshman, Bow led the Storm and Pointers with 26 goals. "She's an amazing leader," Bow said, "and I looked up to her so much last year. She's an absolutely phenomenal player. She leads everyone out there by her play, her actions, and her words. She's a great player and person." Daly, a senior, takes on more of the quarterback role for CPU as a midfielder. Daly and Bow were both named first team all WAMAC Conference, all district, and all state in 2022. Centerpoint Urbana finished 15-4 and lost in the state quarterfinals to top-ranked Davenport Assumption 1-0. Was the first time the program had made the state tournament since its run to the semifinals in 2019. Much of 2022's success, Daly and Bow attribute to strong team chemistry, something they'll strive to replicate in 2023. "I think once we work on chemistry, we'll be set," Daly said. "We lost a little bit of talent, but we gained a tremendous amount of talent. There are amazing freshmen coming in, and the sophomore class is extremely athletic. I think it'll be great as long as we can get that chemistry back. If our team's close, we can definitely go far," Bow said. Here are the girls' soccer players and teams to watch. Emily Bow, a sophomore from Centerpoint Urbana, Class 1A first-team All-State forward, who led a state tournament team with 26 goals in her first season. Also, Rylan Breenholt, a sophomore at Iowa City Liberty, led the Lightning with 10 assists and scored 11 goals in her first season, Class 2A second-team All-State. Claire Brown, a senior from Iowa City High, is a player to watch. Also, Madison Daly, a senior from Centerpoint Urbana. Grace Garda, a senior from Iowa City Regina. Maya Marquardt, a junior from Iowa City Liberty. Easton Miller, Independence. Janelle Miner, a senior from Cedar Rapids Kennedy. Regan Hess, a senior from Cedar Rapids Prairie. Abby Roberts, a sophomore from Linmar. Cassie White, a senior from Cedar Rapids Kennedy. And the teams to watch, Centerpoint Urbana. Three All-State picks return from a team that took off in mid-April last spring, winning 12 out of 13 games before running into top-seeded Davenport Assumption in the Class 1A state tournament. Another team to watch is Independence. With eight freshmen in the starting 11 last year, the Mustangs went 14-3, won the WAMAC West title, and advanced to the Class 2A regional finals. Among the now sophomore class are the first-team all-conference honorees Addison Lang, Arabella Lovar, and Marcelina Weber. Iowa City High, only three seniors started last year for a team that won eight straight late, including a 6-1 regional semifinal win over Cedar Rapids Kennedy before running into fourth-ranked Waukee Northwest. Linmar, the Lions were undefeated against Iowa teams with a 111-9 scoring margin before losing by a goal in the Class 3A regional finals. First-team All-MVC selections Emma and McKenna Friedman are among the numerous returning starters for Linmar. And Solon, almost everyone is back from a 16-4 team that reached the Class 1A regional finals. Second-team All-State forward Morgan Link had 23 goals and 8 assists last season. Turning to the Business 380 page, this story is by Isabella Zaluska. DeliMart, five locally owned convenience stores in the Iowa City area, permanently closed over the weekend and will reopen as Casey's General Stores. "Thank you for your business for the last 37 years," reads a sign posted on the door of the Deli Mart at Lower Muscatine Road and First Avenue in Iowa City. Casey's is buying the 5 locations in Iowa City and Coralville. Deli Mart's employees will be offered a role at Casey's, Casey's spokeswoman Katie Petru said in an email on Monday. Brothers John and Frank Moreland opened the first Deli Mart in 1985 on Highway 1 in Iowa City. "To make a long story short, we decided to build a convenience store so he could run it," John Moreland said of his younger brother. A few years later, in 1988, the two opened another store on Mormon Trek Boulevard, opening 4 more stores and a car wash in the following years in Iowa City and Coralville, John Moreland said. The 6th location was sold, he said, leaving 4 deli marts in Iowa City and 1 in Coralville. Frank Moreland bought the stores from his brother in 2005. "We created the image from scratch," John Moreland told the Gazette. "We had a lot of ideas from other stores and stuff like that. We just came up with the concept and all that." Frank Moreland, the majority owner of the business, died at age 59 in November of 2021 from complications of COVID-19, according to his obituary. And Megabus expands service to Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. Megabus, one of the largest bus companies in North America, is partnering with Burlington Trailways to expand bus service to 48 Midwestern cities, including Cedar Rapids and Iowa City. The company will be adding daily trips between Cedar Rapids and 13 other cities and adding daily trips between Iowa City and 20 other cities. Schedules and tickets are available online at us.megabus.com. Turning now to the community page, here are things to do today. Butterflies of Iowa. Lynn County Master Gardener Angel Burns will teach you how to identify butterflies and how to get involved in the Iowa Butterfly Survey Network. That takes place at 6:30 p.m. at the Ely Public Library, 1595 Dowes Street in Ely. That is free. And in the literature category, In Conversation with Michelle Patrick. Michelle Patrick always loved a spooky tale. Her love affair with Prague's supernatural legends began with the stories her Czechoslovakian grandfather shared, and she's thrilled to be able to take the reader on a magical tour of this most ghostly of cities in her new book, Haunted Prague. Registrations required. That will be online with Swamp Fox Bookstore. It's free, and it takes place from 7 to 8 p.m. Here are the Eastern Iowa briefs for today. In Cedar Rapids, temporary skate park to open at Time Check Park this week. With rising temperatures, the Cedar Rapids Parks and Rec Department will be installing temporary skate park equipment on the basketball court at Time Check Park, 1131 5th Street Northwest, this week. The site will serve as a replacement skate park while the Riverside Skate Park is under construction. The location was chosen based on preferences indicated in a public survey last fall and will close when the new skate park is completed in the late summer of 2023. "We're excited to provide a space for skate park users as they wait for the new park at Riverside Park. We know they are eager to get back outside," said Hashim Taylor, Parks and Recreation Director. "The equipment is portable and will be able to be used for clinics and other events following the completion of the Riverside Skate Park. Equipment includes a combination of quarter pipes, fun boxes, manual pads, and grinding kits. Hours of operation are normal park hours. Those hours are 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. There is not lighting at this location, so caution is urged when skating in early morning and evening hours. Users are asked not to use the equipment when wet or when temperatures are below 32 degrees based on the manufacturer's recommendations. In Fairfield, Fairfield Restaurant Week takes place this week through Saturday and will showcase 17 unique eateries making Fairfield a must-visit destination for food enthusiasts from across the region. Check in at the various restaurants during the week and to be entered into a drawing for a $250 gift card to your favorite restaurant. Many restaurants are hosting their own giveaway as well. For a list of participating restaurants, you can visit www.visitfairfieldiowa.com/fooddrinks/Fairfield Restaurant Week. And in Monticello, Camp Courageous Free Spring Break Bash is set for April 5. Youth campers are getting ready to celebrate the arrival of spring in style at the annual Spring Break Bash at Camp Courageous. This event is designed for special education teachers and students, group homes, and others with individuals with disabilities up to the age of 21. From 9:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. April 5, campers can interact with dozens of other special education classes and groups from all over the area. Campers can enjoy heated indoor pools, climbing activities, hiking trails, arts and crafts, zip line adventures, archery, and more. The day will be capped off with a dance that no one will want to miss. The event is free. Groups are welcome to bring along a sack lunch to enjoy at camp before heading home. For more information or to RSVP, contact Katie Ryan, and that email address is kryan@campcourageous.org. Also on the community page, this story by Aaron Jordan titled Practical Farmers of Iowa Gets Noticed with Billboards. If you've driven through Austin or Rochester in Minnesota, you might have noticed billboards with a pair of bare legs and the phrase, "Don't farm naked." Another eye-catching detail is the billboard promoting off-season cover crops was co-sponsored by Practical Farmers of Iowa. We are trying to recruit farmers from Midwest states to get them enrolled in Cost Share, Practical Farmers of Iowa Executive Director Sally Worley said, referring to a program that helps farmers pay for the costs of growing cover crops or small grains. The group, founded in 1985, has maintained a strong network of producers who want to farm sustainably. When farmers sign up to cost share programs, they not only get financial aid and technical support, but they can connect with Practical Farmers Network for helpful tips and camaraderie, Worley said. We are offering something that is unique. Our network is a really big part of a magic sauce of our operation. More than 1,300 farmers from 8 states, Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Illinois, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, and Missouri, participated in Practical Farmers Cover Crop programs in 2022, growing more than 300,000 acres of cover crops, according to the annual report. Cover crops are plants such as small grains, legumes, and brassicas planted between cash crop seasons to reduce erosion, filter runoff, and create animal habitat. Despite the environmental benefits, cover crops are planted on only about 4% of Iowa farmland each year. Practical Farmers wants to see half of Iowa's farmed acres planted in cover crops, Worley said. One of the hurdles of growing cover crops is the cost to buy seed, pay a contractor to seed the crop, in some cases, and apply herbicide in the spring to kill off the cover crop before corn, soybeans, or other commodity crops are planted. Practical Farmers of Iowa hosted 258 educational events in 2022, with most of those featuring farmers telling their stories and sharing advice for sustainable farming. Practical Farmers has a few billboards in Iowa, but most are white and have simple messages about the organization. But the Land Stewardship Project, based in Minneapolis, wanted to use Practical Farmers' Don't Farm Naked slogan on billboards in southern Minnesota, Worley said. The Minnesota billboards installed a couple years ago do get noticed, she said. We've gotten responses from people who tell us they saw it. Practical Farmers will get more attention in April when its full-length movie, Livestock on the Land, will be screened at the Cedar Rapids Independent Film Festival, April 14. The festival is April 14 to 16 at Collins Road Theaters in Marion. Farmers who grow small grains, including barley, oats, rye, triticale, and wheat, may earn up to $20 per acre for growing those small grains with a legume cover crop, earn an additional $20 per acre for reducing nitrogen on corn that follows small grain rotation. You can receive $10 per acre on up to 200 acres, or 10% of your farmed acres, whichever is larger, and $5 per acre on everything above that. There are no requirements on the species of seeding method used. Farmers who receive cost share from Practical Farmers still can seek assistance from the National Resources Conservation Service. Turning now to the weather page, lightning season is here. This story by meteorologist Hannah Messier. We're continuing Severe Weather Awareness Week with lightning. Lightning can strike up to 15 miles away from a thunderstorm and reach temperatures as high as 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, which is even hotter than the sun's surface. People who have been struck by lightning can suffer from a wide variety of injuries. One person had to relearn how to read and write after being struck. Another had memory loss, headaches, and joint pain afterwards. When you hear thunder, the safest thing to do is to head indoors. Your car also is a safe option if your windows and roof are closed. While indoors during a lightning storm, stay away from plumbing and electronic devices that are plugged into outlets. And a look at the weather today. Partly sunny. High today in Cedar Rapids is 50 degrees and low is 28. 52 for Iowa City. The normal high for today is 53, and the normal low is 31. We set a record high of 81 degrees in 1968, and a record low of 9 in 1970. Chance of snow enters into the forecast for tomorrow with a high of 39 in Cedar Rapids, 41 for Iowa City, and those rain showers persist Thursday and Friday, with the high Friday reaching 65, potentially. We're in the waxing crescent moon phase with moon rise at 11:03 a.m. and moon set at 3:23 a.m. Sunset tonight is at 7:28 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow at 6:54 a.m. That gives us 12 hours and 33 minutes of daylight. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, March 28. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you for listening and have a great, safe day.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is EarthDate.
Since the dawn of humankind, people have used caves to explore, hold religious ceremonies, create art, or avoid the dangers of weather and predators. Partly because of that, they continue to fascinate scientists today. To create a cave, Mother Nature needs three things: water, rock that can be dissolved by it, and lots of time. Rainwater, as it falls through the atmosphere, picks up carbon from CO2 to become a weak carbonic acid. By the time it hits Earth, it's about as acidic as coffee. As it percolates through the soil, it picks up more carbon from decaying plants, becoming a slightly stronger acid. If the rock below the soil is limestone, gypsum, or dolomite, the water can dissolve along tiny cracks. Over many thousands of years, the cracks become channels, then tunnels, and could eventually become caverns. Water might also mix with hydrogen sulfide gas seeping up from natural oil and gas deposits to form sulfuric acid, which can also dissolve the rock. Protected from daily and seasonal changes on the surface, caves can maintain a stable temperature and humidity. In these delicate environments, the remains of ancient animals and humans, which could have quickly decayed on the surface, have been preserved for millennia. Deeper, more isolated caves have preserved bacteria and microbes undisturbed for millions of years. These qualities make caves important sites for researchers, natural time capsules. There's probably an amazing cave near you, so take a trip and get to know your Earth. I'm Scott Tinker, dissolving mysteries on EarthDate.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.